Well, we want to thank you for being with us, Brian Milkovsky, expert in economic recovery in eastern Ukraine, who until January lived in Severodonetsk in Ukraine. That's in the Donbass, helping raise funds for evacuations now from the Donbass. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is an immediate opening for a news writer-producer. Visit democracynow.org/jobs to find out more and apply. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Camille Baker, Chirina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, President Biden lands in Oregon, visiting Portland for the first time as president and since he was last year's vice president in 2014. What do Oregon voters want? A new poll sheds light on what's foremost on their minds. And one more time, COVID-19 cases are on the rise in Oregon and Washington, with yet another subvariant taking hold. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 21st, 2022. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. President Joe Biden made his first visit to the Pacific Northwest since his election, arriving early this afternoon where he spoke at Portland International Airport. In impassioned tones, Biden touted the investments in infrastructure that his administration has promised, including with PDX Next. That's the $2 billion project intended to improve the airport.
You know, the last guy that had this job talked about Infrastructure Week. Every week he'd talk about Infrastructure Week. It didn't come for 4 years. Well, I gave you Infrastructure Decade. This is for 10 years. $1,400,000,000. And Suzanne, who works tirelessly to ensure that we have left out, no one's left out, you know, including women and people of color. We're building a better America. When I got elected, I said, and I meant it, people weren't sure I really meant it, but I said, I want my administration to look like America, to look like America, and it does. There are more women in my administration than men. There are more women in positions of consequence. There are more African-American judges that have been appointed than every other president combined has appointed. Folks, I want to thank you all for everything you're doing for the people of Oregon. We're here today to talk about investments we're making to modernize this airport and this an economic engine for the entire region. Though through the bipartisan infrastructure law, we're investing $25 billion to upgrade and modernize American airports out of the money that is the over $1 trillion we're spending in infrastructure. Airports all across America are second rate. I used to tell the story that if, in fact, I dropped you in the middle of the night in an airport in China, and an airport in the United States, took a blindfold off and said where you were, you'd think the one in China was in America. We've fallen behind. We haven't invested in ourselves. And I want to thank Ron and Jeff, Peter, Earl, Kurt, Suzanne for helping prove that America can do big things again. We can do anything we want to do. bothers the heck out of me that there's this belief that we can't do big things anymore. But we can. We're proven we can. And we must build a better America. And a good place to start is right here in Portland. Folks, look, Portland International Airport is a perfect example of both the need and the opportunity and the ability to make progress. I don't have to tell you that it's an essential economic engine for the entire region, not just Portland. A lot of folks may not know it, but this airport employs 10,000 people. 10,000 people. Every day they show up, airline workers, technicians, retail workers, maintenance staff, and more. In addition, 20 million people travel from this airport every year, bringing 330,000 metric tons of cargo in and out of this state through this airport in the air, shipping seafood from Oregon to fishermen all across America, all across the world, quite frankly, bringing goods from every corner of the country to Oregon homes and businesses. But here's the deal. It's been much too big and too long since America's invested in our own airports, our ports, and our rails. We haven't done it. We used to have the best infrastructure, rated the best infrastructure in the world. This is a fact. We are now ranked by the international community as 13th best infrastructure. 13th, the United States. We've stopped investing in ourselves. We stopped investing in our people. We stopped investing in America. And I know people are tired of hearing me say it, but this time we're going to lead the world and invest in ourselves, invest in the nation, and invest in our people. That's the place to start.
Biden also talked about his plans for lowering health care and energy costs. The president has pushed for Congress to pass legislation aiming at people to get health coverage, even if their state did not expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. He also wants to cap prescription drug prices, such as for insulin, to keep drug prices affordable amid ongoing inflation. Biden also noted what he's doing to lower energy costs, including releasing oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to help lower soaring gas prices. Biden participated at a nearby fundraiser for the Democratic National Committee at the Portland Yacht Club, a short distance north of PDX. His visit was greeted with enthusiastic support by local members of his own party, including Governor Kate Brown and Oregon's U.S. Senators Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley. Republican Congresswoman Jamie Herrera Butler from Southwest Washington said she was hoping Biden would broaden his scope during the visit and address crucial issues such as alarming spikes in crime, particularly the record-breaking homicide rates and rising drug abuse. Biden's next stop is Seattle, where he's expecting to attend another fundraiser before observing Earth Day there tomorrow afternoon. Another spike in COVID-19 cases, this time of a different variant, is hitting our community. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade has the story.
Once again, COVID cases are on the rise in Oregon and Washington, with a surge in hospitalizations expected to follow, though early predictions are indicating the uptick won't be as severe as seen before. Currently, the dominant strain of COVID-19 in the Northwest is the Omicron subvariant, known as BA.2, and is responsible for the recent bump. According to the OHA, daily cases are averaging around 600, roughly three times what it was at the start of the month. Similar rises in case counts had been reported in Washington as well. The good news is the surge is reporting less accounts of severe disease relating to hospitalizations or death and is predicted to be far below the surge we saw with the original Omicron strain late last summer through winter of 2021. With home tests more widely available than before, OHA notes there is likely a much higher undercount in cases, with as much as 5 to 10 times positive tests compared to cases documented by lab results due to people testing at home and not reporting results. During a Wednesday COVID-19 briefing, state health officials say that despite this disparity in case counts, basic trends of the current surge are still more predictable than previous surges, and that state resources, such as vaccines and other treatments, are better prepared to cope with it. Dr. Tom Jean, the deputy state health epidemiologist with OHA, also responded to queries as to whether a mandatory mask mandate would be reintroduced, saying that the state, quote, does not have any thresholds right now that we would consider that, end quote. Jean maintained that Oregon is in a much better spot than before in handling COVID and that previous restrictive mandates will hopefully not be needed. With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
A new poll demonstrates how Oregon voters feel about a number of issues that residents are facing. With more on that story, here's KBOO's Josh Salem.
In February, DHM Research, in partnership with Oregon Public Broadcasting, conducted a survey of Oregonian voters. The purpose was to assess voter priorities in the upcoming 2022 elections, as well as gauge opinions on a range of topics, including climate change, public safety and crime, houselessness, earthquakes, wildfires, and water. The survey consisted of 600 registered Oregon voters and took approximately 16 minutes to complete. Quotas were set by age, gender, race, educational level, geographic area, and political party registration to ensure a representative sample. 50% were male and 50% female. About 73% were self-reported Caucasians, while 2% were Black non-African, 3% Asian and Pacific Islander, and 6% who checked off Hispanic. 18% of respondents feel Oregon is on the right track, while 73% believe we are headed in the wrong direction. In October of 2018, well before the pandemic, things were more evenly split, with 42% each saying things were headed in the right or wrong directions, respectively. Houselessness, termed homelessness, was rated the most important problem facing Oregonians, with 29% choosing that response. 94% said houselessness is a serious or very serious problem. Government leadership is the most important problem, came in at 22%, and crime at 16%. Only 1% said transportation issues were the most serious problems for Oregonians. 31% rated economic conditions as good or very good, but 65% said they are poor or very poor. 62% feel they're getting worse. 27% feel positive or very positive about Governor Brown, with 35% feeling positive or very positive about President Biden. 70% felt positive or very positively about their local police departments. 47% said Oregon should take additional steps to address climate change, while 44% feel we should not. 43% feel we spend too much time on public services and that taxes should be reduced, while 34% feel taxes should remain the same, and 16% think they should be increased. 30% support or somewhat support having a statewide sales tax. Finally, 41% think there is a real likelihood that Oregon will experience a major earthquake in this lifetime, and that the state should be making major taxpayer investments to upgrade infrastructure and educate the public about risk. Assessing how Oregonians feel about those running for public office is tricky. Governor Kate Brown has term limited out of running again, and there are 34 candidates on primary ballots seeking either the Democratic or Republican nominations for governor. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Did It Happen Here? At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, mostly cloudy skies, a low down to 38. Tomorrow's weather, partly cloudy early, showers developing later in the day, a high near 60. The weekend's looking promising, highs in the mid-60s, partly sunny skies. Today in history, on this date in 1970, the first Earth Day was celebrated. It was founded by American politician and conservationist Gaylord Anton Nelson, who helped spark the environmental movement, and it quickly grew into an international event. Our quote of the day comes from Nelson, who said, "The fights in the future will not be over whether we ought to do something, but over how we ought to do it. And that's a reasonable debate." A California healthcare provider expands telehealth abortions into primary care. As Lily Bulkey reports, Dr. Michelle Gomez started providing telehealth medication abortions during the pandemic.
With a Supreme Court decision looming on a case that could decide the future of Roe v. Wade, new telemedicine abortion providers are springing up in California plus 23 other states and D.C. Once the FDA removed longstanding restrictions on mailing mifepristone, that opened up the opportunity for clinicians to offer abortion pills by telehealth and mail. Michelle Gomez is a family medicine doctor in Burlingame who offers medication abortions, both in person and virtually, as part of her primary care practice. California requires insurance to cover abortions, but Gomez says from transportation costs and time to privacy, there still can be barriers.
I've also had patients tell me they couldn't get an appointment for 2 weeks, but they were able to get an appointment with me the same day. The convenience of telemedicine abortion makes a very real and important difference in people's lives, and I'm grateful to be able to help in that way.
Gomez's appointments can be booked online and take from 10 to 30 minutes, depending on what the patient wants to talk about. Her practice takes insurance, but the self-pay price for folks without insurance is about $280. Gomez says her practice is one of a few telehealth abortion providers that do accept insurance.
I've been encouraging Choice and Aid Access to refer patients to me if they want to use their insurance, and I send patients to them or forward midwifery if they need a lower self-pay price. I like the idea of us all working together to get patients what they want and need. No one organization can do it all, but together we can accomplish a lot.
Gomez hopes more primary care physicians will start offering abortion services. She's a co-founder of the Maya Network, which encourages and supports PCPs in providing that option.
Early abortion services, both medication abortion and aspiration procedures, can be provided very safely in the privacy of patients' own doctor's offices. I believe there will always be a role for abortion clinics, but they shouldn't have to do it all, and patients should be able to choose what is best for them.
Gomez adds that while it's great that providers can now mail mifepristone, she hopes the FDA will do even more to make it more accessible. She says restrictions on it are medically unnecessary and just make it more complicated for physicians to prescribe.
Mifepristone has 20 years of safety data. Having a medication abortion is safer than carrying a pregnancy to term, so there's no reason it shouldn't be dispensed in a pharmacy like any other medication.
This story was produced with original reporting from Carrie Baker of Ms. Magazine. This is Lily Volke with California News Service.
Thousands of Ukrainians at the Mexican border seek asylum. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen walks out of a G20 meeting. And the Biden administration makes changes to improve the student loan forgiveness program. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Customs and Border Protection are processing up to 1,000 Ukrainians per day at a port of entry where border officials claimed they did not have capacity to even process 30 other asylum seekers per day for the past few years.
The U.S. has arrested more than 1 million asylum seekers at the Mexican border in the past 6 months. Al Otro Lado immigration attorney Erica Pinheiro says thousands of Ukrainians are at the border in Tijuana. Meanwhile, Panama and the U.S. have signed a commitment to make progress on migration issues. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
Increasing citizen security, combating the climate crisis, improving democratic governance that's responsive to people's needs.
Russia's government has rejected calls from the United Nations chief for a ceasefire in Ukraine during the Eastern Orthodox Holy Week to allow civilians to evacuate the country. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin spoke Wednesday with Poland's Minister of Defense on humanitarian efforts ahead of bilateral talks.
You have helped the Ukrainian people fight for their country and escape from the horrors of war. You have provided much-needed security assistance to the Ukrainian military to help it continue to successfully fight back invading Russian forces.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen walked out of a G20 meeting in Washington Wednesday when Russia's finance minister began speaking. The Department of Education says it will retroactively help millions of federal student loan borrowers held back by income-driven repayment plans by ensuring any months in which borrowers made payments count toward loan forgiveness requirements and, in certain cases, grant forgiveness automatically. Student loan attorney Adam Minsky.
The system is a mess. It can be incredibly confusing for people to navigate. There's been huge documented problems with oversight of complex programs and the administering of those programs as well.
Income-driven repayment programs are designed to provide loan forgiveness to borrowers who have been making payments tied to their income for at least 20 or 25 years. But so far, few borrowers have successfully received forgiveness under those plans. South Carolina's Supreme Court on Wednesday issued a temporary stay blocking the state from carrying out what was set to be its first ever firing squad execution. Richard Moore, scheduled for execution next Friday, has chosen to die by firing squad rather than in the electric chair. Moore was convicted for the 1999 killing of convenience store clerk James Mahoney. The last execution by firing squad in the U.S. was in 2010. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
This Earth Day, advocates are calling for climate action. Suzanne Potter reports from Nevada.
To honor Earth Day tomorrow, Governor Steve Sisolak will join environmental advocates in a call to invest in our planet. The most recent report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change said the world only has about 8 years to take decisive action to avert the worst effects of global warming. Nevada already is being ravaged by wildfire and drought. Angeline Tabalba with the Nevada Conservation League says the state's biggest source of drinking water is at a record low.
2021 was the first time our federal government announced there was a water shortage at Lake Mead. So we have all these things that are telling us that we do need to act on climate to protect our communities from this dangerous extreme weather.
The bipartisan infrastructure bill will give Nevada $38 million over 5 years to build out electric vehicle charging networks, and the state's new clean car standards go into effect in 2025. But activists say in order to truly tackle climate change and confront volatile prices for fossil fuels, the Senate needs to pass the Build Back Better Act, which would put $555 billion toward climate mitigation, clean energy, and environmental justice. Tabalba says the average low-income family in Nevada spends about 6 to 8% of their income on energy costs, something Biden's climate legislation would address.
With federal investments in more energy efficiency and electric infrastructure, the average family could save about $500 per year in utility bills.
She says the climate legislation would reduce the cost of installing rooftop solar panels by an average of $7,000. Nevada is home to the country's number one solar economy, employing almost 34,000 workers as of 2020. This is Suzanne Potter reporting. For Nevada News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
A government report says a housing program for Native veterans falls short. A new Cherokee cannabis dispensary in North Carolina could rival gaming revenue. The body of a missing Santee Sioux teen is found on a reservation. And a Connecticut Board of Education will invite tribes to testify about school mascots. With more on these stories, here's Shirley Jihad with National Native News.
A new report says a housing lending program aimed at helping Native American veterans falls short and is severely underused. The Government Accountability Office issued that report this week. It says only a tiny fraction of people get help under the Native American Direct Loan Program. It's operated by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. It is supposed to assist veterans who are Native American in buying, building, or fixing up housing. But it helped fewer than 1% of those eligible. Over nearly the last decade, the report says, the program originated 89 loans in the contiguous United States, 91 loans in Hawaii, and zero in Alaska. And that all represents fewer than 1% of the nearly 70,000 eligible veterans. Revenue from a new cannabis enterprise planned for the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians Reservation in North Carolina could rival the tribe's gaming operations. That's the assessment of Jeremy Wilson, the government affairs liaison for the tribe's principal chief. Wilson also chairs the tribe's economic development arm. Wilson says the dispensary on the Quala boundary land could be one of the largest in the country.
We have to look for different avenues and economical diversification. So for cannabis and the excitement around it, this will definitely present us an opportunity that could be, you know, well worth close to $1 billion.
Wilson says the lack of competition would currently work in the tribe's favor. The tribe intends to start selling cannabis by the start of the new year. Marijuana remains illegal in North Carolina and the surrounding states. The Eastern Band of Cherokee only recently allowed medical marijuana sales on the reservation. The former chairperson of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe is now on trial. He faces charges of bribery and extortion in connection with the tribe's planned casino project. Cedric Cromwell is on trial at the U.S. District Court in Boston. Prosecutors say he used his position as chair of the Wampanoag tribe to get $60,000 in bribes. In exchange, prosecutors say he gave a $5 million contract to a Rhode Island architecture firm. The owner of that architecture firm is also on trial. Cromwell's lawyer says he denies the charges. He calls Cromwell a transformational leader who helped the tribe improve its future. The casino plans for the tribe based in Cape Cod have been delayed for years because of various legal issues. In Nebraska, officials have found the body of a Native American teenager who had gone missing last month. 19-year-old Ashley Wabashaw was a member of the Santee Sioux Nation. Tribal leaders say her body was found on the reservation. They offer no further information. Now the FBI is investigating her death. After a lengthy debate this week, the West Hartford Board of Education in Connecticut, in a divided vote, decided to invite leaders of five recognized Native American tribes to come speak about the issue of team names and mascots. That's to happen at a public meeting in May. The school board there already committed to replacing high school teams' names, Warriors and Chieftains. They plan on approving new names for the school's teams by June. But a handful of residents are speaking out at meetings petitioning the community to keep those names. They say they talked with tribal leaders, and they claim, the residents claim, that tribal leaders told them the names are a source of pride and should remain. School board members who voted against the effort say it is redundant. They say the school board has already gone over all of this and already received feedback in writing from tribal leaders. With National Native News, I'm Shirley Jihad.
Salmon fishing in the Northwest ended early this year, but help is on the way. Gas prices could accelerate the transition to electric vehicles. Federal officials are on tour promoting a playbook designed to help rural communities access billions in infrastructure money. And residents of the Navajo Nation experienced the flip of a light switch for the first time. For more on the stories affecting rural communities, here is the Yonder Report.
Getting infrastructure funding is a priority for rural communities, but Daily Yonder journalist Bryce Oates says gaps in know-how and personnel can hinder their efforts.
They might not have a grant writer on staff. They might not have the money to hire one. They might not have local economic development officials that they can tap.
White House officials are touring the states to introduce a so-called rural playbook on how to access the billions of dollars made available through the bipartisan infrastructure law.
Whether that be for water or wastewater projects, for internet build-outs in rural areas, or for roads and bridges.
Gas prices averaging more than $4 a gallon may accelerate the transition to electric vehicles. Zander Brown has more.
The Department of Energy estimates the cost of charging an electric vehicle is $1.16 a gallon. Good news money-wise for drivers, says Julie Suter with the Electrification Coalition.
For those who drive extended distances more than the average American driver, there's a real benefit to electric vehicles in terms of the cost savings.
Though electric vehicles can be charged at home at a modest cost, charging away from home still presents immediate issues.
You're not going to build out 100% of the charging infrastructure that you're ever going to need. You're going to gradually build out the charging infrastructure, and then you're going to see gradual incremental vehicle adoption.
The recently passed $1.25 billion infrastructure bill supports building charging infrastructure in rural and underserved communities. I'm Zander Brown.
Sport fishing, the Columbia River is the only source of tourism for many towns of Southwest Washington, cut short this month for lack of fish. Anglers, however, are encouraged. State officials say they'll have a plan by July to replace the four lower Snake River dams blamed for destroying the salmon runs.
These fish don't have another two decades.
Bob Reese with the Northwest Guides and Anglers Association says it's the most encouraging movement he's seen on this issue in the past two decades. Most of Reese's clients come from urban areas.
They want to come out and enjoy these beautiful rural settings and have a chance at one of these prized salmon.
This spring, volunteer utility crews are bringing electricity to 300 more homes on the Navajo Nation. Resident Shirley Chi wished her parents had lived long enough to see the power come on.
Me and my sister were just crying, saying, "Oh, Mom, Dad, look at the lights. Look at the porch lights. They're all on."
Known as Light Up Navajo, the 10-state collaborative project electrifies each home for a value of $5,500. But utility line worker Mark Henley suggests it's hard to put a dollar value on the experience.
The family was kind enough to come out and say hi to us after we finished it up. And they're like, "You know, we've been out here waiting for 30 years for you to get power to us." It was emotional.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown. For more rural stories, visit dailyyonder.com.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 21st, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Josh Salem, Lily Bulkey, Suzanne Potter, and Mark Richardson. The producer is Annette Newell. Our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell, so glad you could join us. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. So if you would like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Did It Happen Here?
This radio show contains graphic descriptions of violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
This radio show was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
By the mid-90s, I was somewhere else. This was had started in the 80s for me, so I was kind of the beginning, and then, you know, I kind of stepped out probably 92, 93. I had a someone had been murdered. I even moved to Eugene for a while to lay low because